You're listening to the We Lead Well podcast. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchats.com, and the Teach Well Alliance. Enjoy the show. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the We Lead Well podcast. I'm Vicky Maguire. I'm a coach working in schools with leaders and teachers to help them to improve their well-being. Well, for this latest episode of the podcast, I am really happy to introduce you to Ben Solly, who is the principal of Uppingham Community College in Rutland. I first came across Ben when I received my copy of the Sec Ed Bulletin. If you don't get that, I would highly recommend it. It's a brilliant bulletin that I get every month, I think it is, and it's got lots of really useful articles to do with schools, teaching, pedagogy, and all sorts of interesting topics. And Ben had written an article on how we can improve well-being in schools, and it was a really well-written, thoughtful, useful article, and I just thought it would be brilliant to get him on the show. So I've interviewed him after reading quite a few of his articles. Actually, he's very very knowledgeable and writes in a very insightful way. I really enjoyed reading his pieces. He is a super lovely guy. I am sure that you are going to really like him. He is very unassuming and very modest, but has lots of really sensible, pragmatic ideas about how you can improve well-being in your school and how you can improve your own well-being. Once again, I was enjoying the interview so much with Ben that it went on for quite a long time. It is getting on for an hour, but I do assure you, if you commit to listening to it, you will really enjoy it. You are going to absolutely love Ben, and then I'm sure you'll go away and you'll read all his articles and you'll follow him on Twitter, because he is just a brilliant, brilliant guy. So here's the interview. I have no doubt you're going to enjoy this one today. Ben Solly, welcome to the show. It's really good to have you here. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Is it snowy there? It's quite snowy here.
It's very snowy. Actually, I've had to close our school site today because it's really high up in Uppingham, up in Uppingham, and we get snow much worse than a lot of the surrounding places. And it's,
oh, really?
There's no easy route into Uppingham. You've got to go up a really steep hill, no matter which direction you come from. And so it's just, when it snows, it's really challenging for us to open the school. So the key worker provision that we had open for about 30 students, it's had to close for today, but it certainly looks beautiful outside.
Wow. Snow days, they're not the same as they used to be. Everybody used to be desperate for a snow day or a boiler breakdown so that school would be closed. And now we've had so many, I suppose, the equivalent of snow days, that it just doesn't have the same, it's not as desired or as desirable as it was, is it?
That's not quite as exciting.
It's quite funny. Okay, so can you just introduce yourself to the listeners and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, of course. So my name's Ben Solly. I'm principal of Uppingham Community College, and this is my fourth year there now. Before that, I was head teacher of Lutterworth College, which is a large 11 to 18 school in Leicestershire. I spent 3 years there, but I started my teaching career in the Black Country, which is where I grew up, near Wolverhampton. And my first teaching post was in a school called the Coseley School, which is no longer there. I started off as a PE teacher and worked with a really talented group of members of staff in that PE department. It gave me loads of opportunities really early on in my career, and so I became an advanced skills teacher quite quickly. Spent a couple of years doing that and then moved into senior leadership roles and came over to the East Midlands, which is where I've settled. And, being at Uppingham, or, you know, we fondly refer to the school as UCC. I've been at UCC now almost 5 years, and it's just brilliant. Absolutely love it. So it's, you know, my dream job.
That's amazing. I love it when people say they're in their dream job or, you know, they wouldn't do anything else. It's brilliant. I was looking, the reason that I got you on the show is because I was looking at some of the articles that you've written for SecEd. And one of the ones that I was looking at, I think the latest one, is about staff wellbeing. So I started having a look at some of the things that you'd done, and I was looking on your Twitter feed, and I saw that one of the things you've done is developed a wellbeing charter. And I know a number of schools have done this, but when I looked at yours, it felt to me like it was a little bit more authentic than some of the others that I've seen. So can you tell us how you developed that, first of all, and how did you ensure that it's a working document and it does have that authenticity to it, rather than something that just is paying lip service to something that people feel is the latest fad in education?
Well, I think looking after the staff and making sure you've got the, you know, the requisite working conditions for people to be able to do their jobs to the best of their ability should be the number one priority for the head teacher. You know, I consider the first line of my job description is to create the conditions where everyone in the school can thrive. And that, for me, that starts with the staff. So it's not about, you know, these gimmicks like cake on a Friday, like we previously discussed. Sometimes it comes down to like the boring things like policies and working practices, and making sure you get all those structural aspects of the school right so that they work for the staff rather than against the staff. And when I became a head teacher, I thought to myself, I'm going to use this opportunity to strip away all of the nonsense from teaching, all of the things that have always really annoyed me as a teacher, and just focus on the things that make the biggest difference. And I think if you can create those conditions in your school where there's a healthy culture, and you know, staff feel valued and trusted, and then you make your policies and processes work for you, that's probably the best thing that you can do as a head for the well-being of your staff. You know, and then you can give them cake on Friday as the icing on the cake, but actually what you've done is you've authentically created a school environment where the staff can thrive. And you know, we've worked tremendously hard over a number of years really to produce that wellbeing charter. It's not just something that's happened, you know, by magic. It's not something that, you know, I've seen some schools advertising specific senior leadership roles for looking after the wellbeing of staff. And whilst, you know, there's an element of me that thinks that's quite admirable, they're putting, you know, that's a high currency to well-being in that school. You know, number one, I think it's the head teacher's responsibility to set those conditions. And then two, it's all leaders' responsibility to make sure that the environment in the school is one where staff can succeed. So, you know, we produce this document and we live and breathe it every day. And it's nothing complicated, but we worked through, because what you asked me was, how have we made it authentic? And that's come from working alongside the staff. It's not me saying this is what we do to prioritise wellbeing. This is me sitting down with the senior leadership team, sitting down with our extended leadership team, our heads of department, and saying, you know, what are the things that we do on a regular basis, day in, day out, that make the difference to the wellbeing staff, that enable people to do their jobs as best they possibly can do? And we just worked through the list, and then we said, OK, well, what could we do more of? What should we do less of? And I think one of the things that the pandemic has shone a light on is there are so many things not going on in schools currently that always feature in a school calendar, and you know, I'll be seriously questioning, do we put those back in when we go back to some form of normality, whatever that looks like? I'm going to hopefully use the opportunity to strip away even more nonsense, because we're doing okay without it at the moment. And yeah, there's always things that have traditionally plagued and sapped away at a teacher's time, like pointless meetings and you know, so many things that get in the way of teachers doing their jobs properly. And I'm really keen to strip away as much of that as possible.
I think that's so important, looking at, you know, and that's one of the things in your charter, isn't it? The taking things away, not adding things on. How do you go about balancing that? Because teaching is really demanding. And I think when staff are, I've got a 14-year-old son creeping into the room here who is obviously asking me, can he, it's in my coat pocket. He's asking for his, I had to go to the post office this morning and I took his card, his bank card. So now he's trying to buy something. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
We'll have an appearance from your 11-year-old maybe just add things, and then Ruby will make an appearance, which she usually does in the show. So I was saying that it's really one of the things that really got to me as a deputy head is 22 out of 25 lessons, you know, a teacher has to be teaching, and then outside those there are the basics of teaching that you have to do. And yes, you can strip away all of the other stuff, you can take away some of the data entry points, you can strip your reports right down so that there are no comments anymore, you could do parents evenings virtually, there are lots of things that I see that you can do. But essentially, if you're teaching 22 out of 25 lessons a week, and then you've got assessment or feedback, whatever format that takes, and planning and meetings that are necessary, it is a demanding job. So how do you go about reducing the pressure in that respect?
So one of the key aspects I think that have made the biggest difference at UCC was when we introduced a feedback for learning policy, and we worked for about a year on that with all of our teaching staff. We'd previously been involved in the Embedding Formative Assessment project, which was part of the SSAT national programme, which was led by Dylan William, and UCC was one of the lead schools in that. And we've subsequently become an ambassador school for the SSAT because we really picked that EFA ball up and ran with it. And it was just embraced so wholeheartedly by our staff. And it was probably the biggest driver in improving the results that actually students achieved at the end of their time at the school, because our teachers just became so good and so effective at formative assessment. And therefore, the bane of an English teacher or a history teacher.
Yeah. I'm an English teacher, so I know exactly what you're referring to.
The marking load is outrageous. And we looked at what's the most important aspect for a student when it comes to moving their learning forwards. Is it the summative assessments that they get at the end of a unit test, or is it the instant feedback that they receive from their teacher in a lesson about what they're doing at that time, you know, closing that feedback loop? And I always use the sort of the Olympic athlete analogy. When you see a long jumper or I don't know, a javelin thrower at the Olympic Games, they perform their event, and then they instantly run over to the crowd and they speak to their coach, and their coach just gives them one or two little things to tweak for the next performance. They don't send the video off to their coach, wait a week for the coach to analyze it, and then have a look at what the coach has said for them to improve, because you know that's just too long. So if we apply that to learning in a classroom, then actually our priority has got to be that formative assessment that happens that is often invisible to somebody who might come in and scrutinize to say, well, how is this teacher doing a good job? Are they marking their books? And so our feedback for learning policy is really explicit in saying, you know, we don't expect to see marking in books. There's no designated frequency that we expect that to happen. What we prioritize is assessment for learning, formative assessment in the classroom, and we trust our teachers to do that. And we've invested so much of our CPD time in upskilling our staff to be able to deliver that effectively, and we trust them to go away and do that. And we're really clear with parents and with students about what that will look like, because you know a traditional or you know a common issue that might occur is a parent might open up their child's exercise book and say,
"I was just going to ask you that very question."
There's no marking here. What's the teacher doing? And actually, what you'll see if you open an exercise book from a UCC student is you might not see huge amounts of teacher comments, but you'll see lots of self-assessment, lots of peer assessment, which has been really carefully structured. You might see the odd bit of teacher assessment, but we've asked our teachers to be really specific about which pieces of work they assess, why they assess it, and so that all the assessments that we actually do, because they are so time consuming, they have a really strong element of reliability and validity to them, because if we're going to do an assessment, then it should contribute towards the data that we do analyse, so that we can progress our teaching based on that information and we can support students with the learning. And so we've tried to strip everything back to the absolute basics so that teachers can prioritise. And it's just been about prioritising the things that we believe make the biggest difference. So, you know, we look at educational research, but we look at it through a critical lens, and we say, okay, this is what these researchers have said, but in our school, in our context, our students, our community, what works for us? And we've shaped our policies around that. And therefore we only add in any kind of strategies that have a direct impact on those things that we identify as making the biggest difference. And then we try and strip away absolutely everything else.
You know, it's really interesting that you've said that. And one of the things that I do is I'm an MPQSL online tutor. So I work with the candidates as they're going through the assessment, the assignments that they're doing. One of them was on assessment, and it was talked about reliability and validity that you just mentioned there. And there's also an assignment that we've done on curriculum. And I don't think some leadership teams or head teachers understand how well trained their leadership team needs to be and how much knowledge they need to gain in terms of, because we're now designing our own curriculum and our own assessments, how much training and knowledge they need in those areas. Is there something you've done specifically to ensure that your senior leadership team are able to have that knowledge to oversee aspects of the curriculum and assessment that you're designing?
You know, as I was sort of progressing as a teacher and as a leader, for a long time I just got by on common sense, intuition, instincts. You know, I didn't read that much in terms of education books or research. And then when I managed to get as far as becoming a head teacher before I actually started engaging with this stuff, and luckily I started a sort of reciprocal coaching partnership with another head who was more experienced, and he really opened my eyes up to these things. And he said, you know, you, as a senior leader, you've got to read, you've got to understand these things, because you know, you've done well to get this far, but you won't go any further unless you really start to, you know, develop your own understanding of it. So I just dived straight in with two feet and absolutely loved it. And so I've really encouraged that, not just through senior leaders, through all staff in school. To the point where we disaggregate one of our training days in the year to academic reading. And every year we buy a member of staff a book of their choice on an educational topic of their choice. And sometimes it's not even education related. Sometimes it's related to wellbeing. Yeah. And the staff have a period of time. We normally give them about, you know, half a year to read through that book, reflect on it. And then we do a kind of like market stall event where we share the books and we share the things that we've learned from that. And that's sort of bred a really healthy culture of learning amongst the staff in the school. We've made that just a sort of a visible consistency in the way that the adults work in the school. You know, we're learners ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, my job as the head is to be the lead learner in the school and set that example. And then from that, you know, you asked about curriculum. How senior leaders,
because I think the curriculum is it's huge. It's almost, there are aspects to the curriculum that are philosophical. There are aspects of the curriculum that are more practical. Unless you understand how children learn, then you can't create a curriculum that suits the needs of your learners. Mm. So I think there's a lot of understanding that you need in order to, you know, we had levels, you know, snatched from us. And as much as we didn't like levels, it was a structure that we were working within where we felt like people who knew what they were doing had created a system that we could work within. And now, you know, we were then thrown into, right, we're taking levels away. Do what you want, do what suits you. But I think in a lot of schools, there isn't the knowledge and the understanding of how children learn and how curriculums should be created and developed. So how have you gone about that?
Well, we've sort of gone through that process of, we've spent a lot of time training the staff on curriculum. And you talked about how sort of the removal of levels and, you know, the freedoms that academies have to create their own curriculum. I think that's incredibly, those things have been incredibly liberating for the profession if you've approached it in the right way. If you're just still trying to sort of mould what you're doing into a straitjacket of national curriculum levels or what has always been taught.
Or then, GCSE exams, I think a lot of schools have looked at.
Yeah, or they've moved things that were previously studied at GCSE down to Key Stage 3, just because that's what they're comfortable with delivering.
Yeah.
And the GCSE content's become more challenging. And so they haven't really been that creative with what they've done at Key Stage 3. But actually, if you look at this as an opportunity to shape your Key Stage 3 curriculum, you know, the subject that the teachers are passionate about, you know, they chose to do probably A-levels and then a degree in that subject. And so they live and breathe it. They're so passionate about it. So why not use that as an opportunity to teach young people about the most exciting things about in your subject? And you weave in the important knowledge that they need to have, you weave in the important skills that they need to develop that will enable them to succeed at Key Stage 4 and beyond. But actually, you know, the content, that's up to you. And then how you assess that is also up to you. So the curriculum almost becomes your Bible, certainly at Key Stage 3. And I think some schools have really missed a trick with trying to mimic old assessment frameworks. Mm. When actually what you should be doing is saying, this is the curriculum we decided for our students. This is a sort of inspirational, challenging curriculum. It's at least as challenging as the national curriculum, hopefully, you know, more so. And then that becomes the assessment model, you know, the curriculum becomes that assessment framework. And you just assess students on how proficient they are with sort of retaining and applying the knowledge and applying the skills that they've developed through the teaching. So that becomes the progression model, not all these, you know, I think as an English teacher, you'll probably remember the dark days of APP grids.
yeah.
You know, just how much of a time sap that on a teacher.
Or 33 or whatever it was, different assessment focuses for reading, writing, speaking and listening. Yeah,
think I remember those work, days. That work to sort of benefit ratio, the amount of work that a teacher would put into an assessment, delivering an assessment framework like that compared to what output is there, you know, what benefit is the student going to get from that? Actually, what benefits? They're just jumping through hoops. And so you create an ambitious curriculum and you then use that as the progression model each year. And so one of the practical things that we did was, first of all, give staff the training. So opening up their eyes to some of the, you know, the great books, the Mary Meyer book on curriculum, which was published a few years ago, which just magnificent. And then exploring what the curriculum is, what the purpose is. We spend a lot of time with our staff saying, well, what do we actually mean by knowledge? What do we mean by understanding? What do we mean by skills? Let's come up with a consistent set of words that we all use together. That becomes our common language. And then when you've got every single member of staff, you know, knowing on an understanding on a deep level what those terms actually mean, and then giving examples of what that looks like in your subject, then you can start to build your curriculum model. And then we just gave them time. You know, we completely wiped away our 1265 as much as we possibly could. And we just gave staff the time. So there was very, very few staff meetings, staff briefings. We stripped back department meetings and got people to work, you know, efficiently through electronic methods. So any time that staff spent together, they were working on their curriculum and their assessment framework. We called it embedding curriculum time. That was the term that we called it. You know, everyone loves an acronym in education. And so we said, you know, this is your ECT.
Embedding, you can't call it that anymore though, because there's confusion there, because we've got ECTs now who used to be NQTs, early career teachers. Right.
giving teachers that valuable opportunity. And what we did, we used the model that had been developed through the embedded formative assessment program. So that was founded on the principles of teacher learner communities. And we had groups of teachers, you know, periodically coming into small groups to work on aspects of formative assessment, and then going away and applying it, and then coming back to those groups and reflecting. And we used that model, but we used it with they were all mixed up in terms of all the subjects were mixed up when we did the EFA project. When we sort of evolved that into embedding curriculum time, obviously teams were working together in departments and shaping their curriculum, and everyone was at different stages. So, you know, one department might have had really advanced curriculum plans, and therefore their focus was on, you know, far more advanced things than a team that were maybe building their curriculum from scratch because they were new to school and they were inheriting something that they didn't particularly want to go on delivering. And so, you know, just giving them the time was incredibly liberating. And we probably would have been in our, this would have been our third year of doing that now, but obviously
it's
been heavily disjointed. And when we returned to school in the autumn term, just before Christmas, we just had no staff meetings. We just focused on allowing teachers to come into school, deliver their lessons, and then go home. And that was one of the biggest things from a wellbeing perspective that helped teach through the sort of the pandemic term when we were in school. I just thought, well, it's hard enough being here, teaching in a different way, keeping 2 meters away from the students. The best thing that we can possibly do is not give them anything else to concentrate on other than coming in, delivering their lessons as best they can, and then getting themselves home to the families.
And I think that was the right thing to do at the time. I heard of schools who were carrying on with their monitoring, evaluating programmes, and as the calendar had been created to do. And I just, at the time, I just thought, that's just absolute madness. The most stressful time that we've ever had in teaching, and some schools were continuing to put stress on their staff. I was just thinking, when you were talking about what the work that you've done with the curriculum, how that is so, such an important part of wellbeing for staff, that idea that you empower staff to be the masters of their own destiny. That sounds really cliche, doesn't it? It sounds like it's, I don't know where that came from, but that idea that they're in control of what they do, and then that they, like you were saying, that it, I think it can bring back their passion for their subject, because they get back to thinking, actually, what is my subject? What am I delivering? And I think in the past, like you said, we've spent a lot of time where, like, you just come in and this is what you think teaching is, you deliver some lessons, you go home. And actually we don't, in, I think in a lot of schools, they don't provide an environment in which you can explore your role as an intellectual, and how your own subject knowledge is so important to being able to develop the subject knowledge of the children in your subject. At the last school that I worked, I was saying before I left that this year what I wanted to do in terms of CPD was spend much more time allowing departments to focus on subject knowledge. So, for example, in English, we would take a poem, and if we had a twilight session, we might take two poems and have a really good discussion about our own responses to those poems and really talk about them and then compare them to another poem. Because I don't think in schools we get much time to actually enjoy our subject, just for the pure enjoyment of it. And when you do that, when you teach the poem, then it's so much more powerful, because you've almost been through the process yourself. And I think it's about creating that environment in which staff can be responsible for their own development, would you say?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I think it's incumbent on head teachers to put teachers right up there. You know, they are the experts in the classroom. And, you know, sometimes you might get parental complaints or students complaining about a teacher teaching in this way or not doing this or not doing that. You know, that person is the expert in delivering their subject. And actually, they should be highly respected for that. And if we, as professionals, give them that trust and respect, and then space to develop their curriculum, you'll get the passion, because people have got the autonomy and the responsibility to drive it for themselves. They're not being told to do it in a certain way, they're not being told to deliver a certain style. And I think teachers really value that.
I think there's also, it's also important that staff feel like they can say, actually, do you know what? I'm not very good at teaching poetry. It's never really been a strength of mine. I have to admit, I love reading poetry, but I don't think I'm the best teacher of poetry. I can teach writing brilliantly, but I think it's also about creating the environment in which staff are given time to look at the curriculum and say, actually, which aspects of that do I need to focus on developing? And I wanted to link that to, I don't like appraisal, to be honest. I prefer the idea of development. I think you've done that in your school, and you've taken away appraisal. And I think it would be much better to link that idea of, where are the gaps in my own subject knowledge? Have you done anything like that in your school? Can you tell us about what you did with the appraisal system?
That's exactly what we did.
Before we find out how Ben totally transformed the appraisal system in his school, I just want to tell you a little bit about our partner, headteacherchat.com. Headteacherchat discusses lots of topics, from how to support pupils with learning, how to support parents, and the many issues that come with leading a school. The aim of Headteacherchat is to support headteachers and school leaders who are in a challenging and often lonely role. They do this by offering lots of information for schools to tap into. For example, they have lots of fantastic education companies on their database for leaders to discover, as well as leadership templates to download. They've written product reviews for leaders who are looking for products for their school. And this year, they've even launched the very first school leader planner, especially designed to help leaders to be productive and organised. If you'd like to hear more about Headteacherchat, you can find them on their website at www.headteacherchat.com. Headteacherchat. It's what head teachers are talking about. Now let's get back to the interview and find out how Ben totally changed the appraisal system at Uppingham Community College.
Going back to my philosophy of trying to strip away all the things that have always really annoyed me as a teacher, you know, that whole performance management, performance related pay.
A performance, isn't it? It actually is a performance. Like, you'd have your meeting, set some targets, never look at them. Come back to your mid-year review and go, oh, what were my targets? I better do something. And then come back to it again after a year and go, oh, yeah, look, that's what I did.
It was just an absolute shambles. It was a complete waste of everybody's time. And then to tie that to people's career progression and pay, I just think goes completely against all the things that I'm trying to develop in autonomous teachers who are passionate about their profession, their career, their own personal development. And actually, I thought it was counterproductive. I thought it was demotivating. What we want is a process that empowers people and motivates people. And so we have this thing, we've ditched performance management, and we call it personal improvement planning, or PIP for short. And what we do, it's still an annual process. Every teacher is still expected to complete that, but we don't have any data-driven targets, which are also a complete nonsense because, you know, there are so many reasons why a teacher is responsible for the progress that those children make over five.
So many variables as well within a class, aren't there? It's just...
Yeah, but some schools still do it. You know, plenty of schools still do it. And, I just feel for people that work in those type of environments. So we have this PIP process, personal improvement planning. The first target for absolutely everyone in the school is to improve my teaching, I will. And then they have that sentence starter, and then they select an aspect of pedagogy or their particular subject, poetry, for instance, that they want to get better at. And then they take ownership of that target. And then we don't do judgmental lesson observations to monitor the quality of teaching and learning. We have developmental lesson observations, which are coaching. So they will have a colleague, doesn't have to be a senior leader, should be somebody who is able to work with them in a positive way. They will observe them and complete two developmental lesson observations throughout the year and just focus on that one specific area that that teacher is trying to work on. And that gives people ownership and autonomy of driving their practice. You know, teaching is our bread and butter, but how much time do we actually spend trying to get better at it? And actually in a busy school day, in a busy school year, littered with a full calendar, not enough of that is happening. And so we're trying to make this whole school process, which has always worked against teachers, actually work for them. So we have our PIP process, which is really successful. And then their other targets that they set, you know, for themselves are related to their contribution towards the team or the, depending on their responsibility within the school. And it's completely driven by them. And then they won for themselves, you know, how else do they want to develop? What projects do they want to lead? And that's just completely flipped that old fashioned notion of performance management on its head. And we are very explicit in our policy. So I'm coming back to some of the boring stuff that you said to me at the start. How do you achieve good well-being? Well, a lot of it comes back to policies and processes. Yeah. Our pay policy, our PIP, personal improvement planning policy, actually says every teacher will move up the pay spine every year as long as they are meeting teacher standards and they fully engage in the PIP process. Now, that doesn't mean 95% of children in my year 11 class have got to make excellent progress by this many decimal points or anything like that, which I really don't have that much influence over. It's actually about me taking ownership of my career, my professional development, and fully engaging with that. So if people are doing the basics, they're meeting the teacher standards, and if they're engaging in that process, which is an obvious one, you know, everyone should want to improve and develop, then they automatically move up. And there's no real great scrutiny of that, because those are the things that we trust people to be doing day in, day out. And people buy into that then. And so there's more ownership of it. And then people are revisiting that more frequently than the previous iteration of a process where you've got set targets, your line manager probably set them for you, and then you probably forgot about them until it was time for that review meeting.
Some people, I think, just had a 5-minute meeting where they said, what do you want to set for your targets? I've got 5 minutes before I have to rush off. Wait, to this. Fine. And then they'd go, yeah, they're okay, I'll sign it. And then it was just totally people paying lip service to something, wasn't it? I find what you're saying really inspirational. And I think what you're talking about really is at the heart of well-being. It's developing professionals and trusting them and respecting them. And I think you're absolutely right. It all sits on, or it's all underpinned by having those policies and processes and structures and systems in place that everybody understands. And making those policies working documents as well, because in lots of schools will take a policy from, I don't know, the key or somewhere like that, and then just search and replace, or find and replace, take that name out and put mine in there, just so I've got a policy for when. But it sounds like your policies are more living, breathing, working documents that the staff understand and that they underpin everything that goes on in your school.
Totally, because, you know, you talked earlier about schools paying lip service to well-being of staff, and you can have, you know, you can have your assistant principal in charge of well-being, you can have your cake on a Friday, you can have your half-termly well-being days where somebody comes in and gives the staff foot massages. If you don't get the basics right, people's working conditions are going to be rubbish, and they are not going to value coming to work, and therefore they're not going to perform to the best of their ability, and your kids aren't going to get the best possible education. And, you know, one of the first things that I thought to myself was, you know, as well as feedback for learning, what else negatively impacts on a teacher's life every day? And it's behavior.
Yeah.
And if the school doesn't get behavior right, you can have all the well-being strategies in the world, but your teacher can be stressed out big time because they're constantly dealing with poor behavior. So again, that's the head teacher's responsibility. It's all leaders' responsibility to set the tone, set the culture. And the approach that I've taken is we eradicate low-level disruption, because that is the thing that just eats away at a teacher's their time during the day, because they're wasting time with redirecting students or chasing them for detentions. So schools can do just really simple things like centralise detentions, reduce the number of warnings that a child will get before they're removed from a classroom. And just those two things we've done has meant that the vast majority of classrooms are uninterrupted, and teachers can just get on with delivering the curriculum. And that has a really positive knock-on effect to their well-being, because they can do their job, they can deliver their subject that they're passionate about, and they've got a captive audience who know that their learning is not going to be disrupted because the teacher is able to deliver the lesson in the best way they possibly can do.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in that respect. And I think on the whole, the vast majority of children don't want to be taken out of the lesson, do they? And I think there's a fear in some schools that if you start removing children from lessons, everybody's going to start playing up so they could be taken out of a lesson. I don't think that's the case. I think that once you identify those children who are regularly being taken out of lessons, you have to put something in place to work specifically with those children. And often that time where they come out of a lesson is an opportunity for maybe a more senior member of staff to work out and talk to that child and work out exactly what is going on with them and to start putting some things in place.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when we introduced that system, we said there will be a spike to begin with because there are going to be some students who just can't cope with that. And we've got to have, it's not a punitive system. It's not there to catch people out. It's there to enable teachers to deliver their curriculum, do their job uninterrupted. And that's what students want. Students want structure. They want calm. They want a safe environment in which they can learn. And so, senior leaders in the schools have got to create those conditions. And so a crucial part of the follow-up with when a child is removed, well, what's happening to them? Are they being asked to reflect on what caused that? Are they working with somebody, a pastoral member of staff who's experienced and qualified to help them, rectify their behaviour and then at some point in the future go back into those lessons and succeed? Because there's a whole host of reasons why that child wasn't able to comply in the first instance. And if you just continue punishing them, that's not going to solve the problem for them. It's just going to lead them down towards a route towards exclusion, which is what nobody wants. But we can't accept that a teacher has to manage the behavior of 30 students and every one of those students has got five opportunities to disrupt before they are removed.
You've got 150 opportunities in one lesson there then, haven't you?
when you have the chance to teach, when you've got to do that. And so I had to have this, because a lot of our teachers wanted to they wanted to have the responsibility, they wanted to pick up their own tab. This is my classroom. I'll be responsible for that. That's very noble, but actually when you start to strip away all those responsibilities for chasing up detentions from a teacher, teachers then become more free to work with their colleagues to plan and to talk about the curriculum or assessment, just sit down at break time and have a cup of tea because they've got five lessons that day and then they've got parents evening after school or whatever. If you don't do that, your teachers will burn out, and so well-being in your school is going to be poor.
I think one of the other things that was the bane of my life, and I'm not a teacher anymore, so I'm going to hold my hands up and say I was absolutely useless at setting homework and taking homework in and checking up on it. In the end, really, I didn't set a lot of homework, and the classes that I taught always made really good progress because I taught them well, and it didn't really matter whether they did piles and piles of homework. But I think that's a real struggle for a lot of teachers. It's something that causes a lot of stress and it takes a lot of time. What do you do about that?
Well, we only set homework that is meaningful. So it's either going to consolidate learning that has very recently happened, or it's going to prepare students for future learning that is about to happen. And so we don't have a structured homework timetable where it's set on certain days, because that that doesn't work. And we give our teachers the sort of trust, the freedom, the autonomy to set homework tasks in the way that they see fit, but using those principles.
Mm.
And yeah, we will record if a student doesn't complete their homework. And then that's monitored as at a sort of a whole school level, so we can pick up patterns, and then, you know, a member of staff from a pastoral team can then intervene and say, well, you know, Ben Solly hasn't handed his homework in for three times this week. I'm gonna give his mum a ring and see if he's playing too much on his Xbox rather than actually doing his homework. You know, the teacher can have conversations with that child in the classroom, but then the teacher isn't expected to detain that child, give up their break time, give up their lunch time. You know, that will happen centrally if that's occurring too frequently.
Yeah, so that takes the pressure off, doesn't it?
Yeah, really, yeah. Clear systems that enable teachers to do their job to the best of their ability. And if you can do that, then I think you have good staff wellbeing.
I think there you said Ben Solly hadn't done his homework three times, but I don't think Ben Solly is the type of person who doesn't do his homework, because I've seen all the things that you're doing in your spare time. So I want you to tell us, I've got two more questions for you. This is one and then I'll come to the other one. So Okay. Tell me how you look after your own well-being, because you sound like someone who's driven, committed, motivated to be the best head teacher that you can and to support your staff in the best way that you can and the children in your school, obviously. So how do you look after your own well-being? How do you take care of yourself?
There's a few ways, really, and I do think about this, you know, quite a lot, deliberately plan for it, because I think if I'm not looking after myself, then I'm not coming to school every day refreshed, energized, motivated. I can't be the best possible head teacher for my school, and therefore that's going to impact on everybody around me. And so I think head teachers have got to take that really seriously. They should deliberately plan for it. One of the school related things, one of the education related strategies that I use for that is we have an external coach who we employ for about 1.5 days a week. And he is an experienced leadership coach. He comes in and he works with leaders in the school, but anybody's got the opportunity to work with him. You know, we've got members of our support staff who work with him as well. And that's been really influential in creating reflective practitioners, but also giving people the headspace that they don't normally get in a busy time. So I've worked with him, I think this is my 7th year as a head. Each of those 7 years I've worked with this guy, big shout out to Dr. John Rowe, who's just been brilliant. And we have this approach to leadership called tension-free leadership, which we work through his coaching to develop amongst the staff. And obviously I have to set the example with that. But being a tension-free leader, and there will be an article coming up in SecEd on that, is a really good way to create well-being for yourself as a head teacher. But then I do the other things, you know, that you would expect: exercise regularly, setting an example. You know, I'm not the first person in every day. I'm not the last person to go home. Quite often, I will do bus duty at the end of the school day and get straight in my car and go home. And I think the pandemic has also shown us that people are very capable of working from home. So do I have to be in my office to do my work? No, I don't. I could be doing that at home. So, if people see me doing that, then it allows them to do that for themselves as well. And that, you know, that took a year or so to probably embed within the school that it's OK. You know, once the school day's over, I don't expect people to be hanging around till 5-6 o'clock. You get yourself home to your family, because some people will want to stay at school, get all their work done, and then go home to their family and switch off. Some people will want to get home as quickly as possible, pick the kids up from school, cook the tea, spend a bit of family time, get the kids in bed, and then they'll do some work.
Yeah.
I'm trying to encourage people to do as little work at home as possible, all the time. Don't have your email notifications coming through to your mobile phone. Don't look at your emails over the weekend. Don't look at them in the evening. And I think especially from a senior leadership perspective, I see so many people struggling with, I received a complaint and it ruined my evening, or a complaint from a parent came through to my phone and it ruined my weekend. And I just think to myself, what are you doing? Just One, don't have email notifications coming through to your phone. Yeah. And two, don't look at work emails on the weekend unless you absolutely have to.
It's interesting because As I said before, I tutor for NPQSL online, and there's a sense in there from some of the participants, who some are senior leaders themselves, some are aspirant senior leaders, that this is not a 9-to-5 job. You have to work weekends, you have to work evenings. My take on that is it can be a 9-to-5 job if you want it to be. And that, as a, if I were a head teacher, which I'm not, and I don't have any plans to be, that would be my aim, to say, if to be able to fit what you need to do into more sociable hours and more manageable hours. If you choose to work in the evenings, if you don't want it to be a 9-to-5 job, if you want it to be an 8-to-3 and 7-to-9 job, that's fine, that's up to you. And if you want to work on weekends. But I think that our aim as leaders should be to say, yes, let people, you know, let's work towards reducing those hours and not make it some sort of badge of honour that people wear proudly that says, I was up till midnight last night marking books, or I sent an email at 1 o'clock this morning. You know, we need to be moving away from that. And I, the word lazy was suggested, I think, in one of the discussion streams that we had. And I had to go on there and say, listen, if people want that job to be 9-to-5 and they can fit that into those hours, then we should respect them for that and not be deriding them and saying, oh, that person left school at 4 o'clock. What a lazy so-and-so. Oh, they should be here till X amount. What's your take on that?
I think education is sort of so far behind the real world in terms of how people work.
Yeah.
The pandemic's shone a light on that, hasn't it? You know.
Yeah.
Many organisations have just been seamless in their transition into having their employees work at home. Obviously, teaching is very different in that regard. But I think about our support staff in school, and a lot of them can do their jobs from home. They don't need to be in school to do their job. So sometimes they've got a full-time employment contract, and they traditionally would have been working in school every day. But we've got this culture within the school. They can go to their line manager and say, I've got a lot of work to get done. I'd like to do it in an uninterrupted
environment, yes,
where someone's not coming in and out. Or can I just spend the next 2 days getting that stuff nailed and work from home? And it's always a no questions, yes, absolutely, you can do. So it's just changing the way that people think. And I think, you know, the example that I gave you earlier where people will see me leaving at the end of the school day because I want to go and pick my son up from school, or I want to go and watch his football match. That's the head teacher setting an example. It's not a badge of honour because people are trusted to do their job. How they do that is up to them because everybody's different. Everybody's got different circumstances.
As long as they're doing it.
As long as they're doing their job, yeah, and they're doing it to the standard that we expect, I'm not really bothered how it's done. And giving people that trust, I think, is an essential element, really.
So that leads me into my last question. This is the last question because I've just looked at the time and realised we're getting close to an hour. So what about those people who, I mean, some people might be listening and going, oh, this is all very, you know, well and good in a school where all these people are so engaged and it sounds like, you know, they're all really interested. What do you do with the cynics? What do you do with the ones who go, oh, God, give me another book to read? I haven't even got time to do my own work, never mind read a book. You know, what do you do about those people?
Well, you've got to get the right people on the bus, haven't you? And that's an essential element. You've got in your team, you've got to have everybody pulling in the right direction. When I've come across people who are obstructive or reluctant, I've often tried to get alongside them rather than sort of butt heads with them. And just talk and just be brutally honest. I can see you're reluctant about this. I can see you're obstructing this. Can you just talk to me about what your issues are? And then just genuinely have a conversation with them.
Listen.
And just explore. Yeah, listen. And then sometimes at the end of that meeting, they've had the opportunity and they feel listened to. You might say to them, well, actually, no, this is the direction the school is moving. And I really need you to buy into this. I know you don't necessarily wholeheartedly agree with it, But the impact of, I don't know, your behaviour or the comments that you made in that meeting actually really undermine what we're trying to do. And I know you want the best for this school. So we might disagree on this, but at least we've had, I've given them the opportunity to have that discussion. Yeah. You know, we've had that in a respectful, professional way, and we move forward. Quite often it's just because they might have a real suspicion about why something is happening in a school.
Most of it comes from fear, doesn't it? When I think of people who I know have been objectionable or not wanting to do whatever it is we're doing, it's often from people who maybe feel like they've been left behind. They don't, you know, they're worried that they won't be able to do it, or, you know, there's some sort of fear somewhere, isn't there? And I think maybe it's about identifying that and working with them and then supporting them to understand what it is they fear themselves. And often that could be coaching as well that would work with those members of staff, wouldn't it?
I'm just trying to think of a couple of examples I can share with you. So one of the strategies that I've used is when I started at UCC and there were some things that we wanted to introduce, I talked to some of the staff and said to them, okay, who is going to be the biggest opponent of this? Who's going to really dislike this? And then I was just really transparent with them and said, I want you to pick, this is what I'm planning to do. I want you to pick holes in this. I want you to tell me what the issues are going to be. I want you to tell me how you think staff are going to react. And again, by having that professional dialogue with them helps to create a little bit of buy-in. And the other thing there is you mentioned coaching. I've seen people just be absolutely turned around in terms of their attitude towards work because they've had that coaching opportunity. And, you know, I introduced coaching structures within the school through the sort of line management hierarchy that we have, which is fine. That's good to an extent. But actually, even if you are being coached rather than managed by your line manager, there's still an element. This person is still the person that holds you to account. There's still an element of yourself you're not going to fully open up to. So therefore, having that external coach, completely confidential, has really been liberating for our staff. And a number of people have been turned around by that because they've never experienced it before. Two, they're having the headspace every week to have a half an hour coaching session with someone who is really helping motivate them, light a fire inside them about the things that they want to achieve in their role. And the other element of that is that they're then starting to get a little bit of ownership in terms of the direction that they go in. And it's not, they're not being told what to do. They're sort of taking control of that a little bit more. And so coaching has been really influential in turning some of those more obstinate people around. And, you know, I'll always use it. I'll always use an external coach if I can, because it's just been incredibly valuable.
It's about developing a self-awareness as well, isn't it? And an ownership. Ben, it's been so great to talk to you. I don't want to end this conversation, but I'm mindful that we've been talking for an hour now and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm sure that you will have inspired many of our listeners to take a new approach or do something differently. So thank you very much. If people want to find you and read some of your articles and look at some of the things that you're doing, where can they find you? And I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, on Twitter, I think my handle is at Ben Solly, SOLLY.
I'll have a look and check.
And the other thing that you can do is mostly they're all on SecEd. So go to the SecEd website and probably just put my name into the search bar and stuff will come up.
Brilliant. I'm going to have to say I will have to interview you again because I didn't get to ask you half the questions that I wanted to. And the professional capital is something that I'm particularly interested in. So perhaps we could do another show looking at that. But thanks so much for your time today. Take care, Ben.
Thank you, Vicky. Bye.
I told you at the start of the interview that Ben was a great guy, and I am totally convinced you will not be able to disagree with me on that point. He talks so much sense that there are just so many things that I'm sure you'll be taking from that. I think Ben has a really good way of looking at the bigger picture of a school, and You know, he's very sensible in his assertion that the policies and the systems and the structures and the processes have to underpin the well-being of the school, and that's what underpins the whole culture of well-being. But I love what Ben says about stripping away all the nonsense, all the stuff that we do in schools, as teachers, as leaders, that just doesn't have any impact on the children and their progress. And we need to have a much closer look at what we do and decide what we can get rid of. I was really interested in the embedding formative assessment work that Ben's done as well with the SSAT and Dylan William. And I will put a link to that work in the show notes because I think it's particularly interesting. You'll find that really useful. And this idea of closing the feedback loop and teacher learning communities that will all be really useful to you if you're trying to create that culture of professionals continually learning in your school. I also think that Ben has a really pragmatic approach to what he's doing. He sees well-being through a different lens, and he seems to have a really good grip on what well-being means, and he sets the example. I think it's really great to hear Ben talk about how, you know, one day a week he goes home and he spends time with his family, because I think that's so important. We've talked in other shows about the importance of nourishment, exercise, doing things that bring you joy and pleasure. And it's important that as a leader, you set the example and you are a role model in that behaviour. And I think it's really great that Ben does that, and he prioritises his family life and he prioritises his wellness, his well-being. And the other thing that Ben said was that he has a coach, and that has contributed to his well-being, and I can wholeheartedly back him in that. I've been coached, I have a coach, and I am a coach, and I do understand how beneficial it can be. So if you would like to have a chat with me about coaching and how it might benefit you, I'd be quite happy to do that. Just go onto my website at www.transformeducationcoach.com and you can find out how to get in touch with me there, or you can find me on Twitter, and we have a We Lead Well group on Facebook. I would love it if you would join us in that community. That would be brilliant. That's the end of the episode today. That's all we've got time for. Thank you so much for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Take care of yourself, take care of your staff, and lead well. This episode of the We Lead Well podcast was brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchat.com, and the Teach Well Alliance.